Broadcasting from the commodity capital of the world, Zurich, Switzerland, this is Insider's Guide to Energy.
This addition to Insider's Guide to Energy is brought to you by Fidectus. Go to www.fidectus.com for more information.
Welcome to Insider's Guide to Energy. I'm your host, Chris Sass, and with me this week is co-host Will. Will, what's going on?
Hey, Chris. Not too much. Excited for this episode.
I'm excited to have you back on the main show. You've been killing it with your stories episodes. You've been getting great downloads, some amazing guests. So having Will Stevenson on the main show is just an amazing thing for us. Thanks for coming back over to this show.
Yeah, what a pleasure. What a pleasure. Great to be back.
Really excited about this episode. We're going to be talking about wind. We're going to be talking about floating wind and things that can happen. I know that renewables are one of your passions. So I was happy when I saw this guest coming to say, hey, we need Will here. What are you expecting today?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm sort of open to kind of hearing all sorts of things. I'm particularly excited about how our guest is looking at kind of development of offshore wind across the globe. My day job is as a power market researcher, so I spend quite a lot of time thinking about wind technologies and such things, and especially roadblocks to the deployment of renewables. So I'm quite keen to get his insight onto that and how his company is getting past those, chiefly.
Yeah, I want to hear about that. I think he does some stuff off of California offshore. I think that'll be interesting to see what's taking place over there. California's always a little bit of a unique enigma, I think, in the energy, especially with renewables and not in my backyard and all kinds of interesting things. So you always have to be careful what you wish for in California, I believe. So it'll be interesting to see his take on that as well. But rather than speculating, let's go ahead and bring our guest on board. I'd like to introduce Jonah Margulis. Jonah, welcome to the program.
Awesome. Hey, Chris. Hey, Will. Great to be here. Excited to talk about floating wind.
Well, fantastic. We are, as you can tell, passionate about energy and hearing about it. But I think before we talk about floating wind specifically, maybe we should introduce you to our audience, who you are, what do you do? I mean, I kind of mangled your name and your introduction, but let's go a little bit more about your background and who you are.
Yeah, that sounds great. You did very well with the name. So well done. I've heard many iterations of it. So you're one of the top. So well done. So my name is Jonah Margulis. I'm the SVP of operations for Aker Offshore Wind. I'm sitting here in the U.S. in Houston actually today. And what we do is Aker Offshore Wind is we are a global offshore wind developer for the deep water. And that's effectively floating. But before we get into what the company does, maybe just a couple seconds on who I am. I've been in the energy industry now for just clicked over 20 years. So I feel that's a milestone in and of itself. And I've been very fortunate to experience really a whole host of different things in the energy world, from power to oil and gas, now to renewables. I actually started in the nuclear industry, so that was kind of cool. Definitely somewhat full circle in some respects and back into the power world. For the last, let's say about 15 years since I've been in Houston, been focused on new technology and bringing new technologies to market in the offshore space, predominantly in subsea and deep water. It's been fun. It's been challenging, pushing limits, failing sometimes, and that's part of innovation, and that's part of what I've been very fortunate to be able to do. For the last about 4 years, since 2017, really have dove deep into offshore wind and very specifically floating wind. I was working with Aker Solutions, so I've been in the Aker family, if you will, for about 8 years. In 2017, we took a very keen interest in offshore wind and floating wind specifically because of our skills in the offshore and the deep water. And specifically, you know, as I joke, you know, things that float, we're pretty good at. We've been doing a lot of work through the years. And we kind of stepped into it with taking a small acquisition, basically a small portion of a company called Principal Power. They're a California-based company that has done some really innovative stuff around the floating substructure that these floating offshore wind turbines sit on. So that journey has led me to Aker Offshore Wind. I officially joined Aker Offshore Wind January 1st of this year. The company's just over a year old. We launched last summer. And I've been very fortunate to start to build a powerhouse team here in the U.S. So starting to ramp up personnel and our ambitions in the U.S. So that's a little about me. I am an engineer by background. So if I do get too technical, just, you know, wave the hand and let me know.
It's a fantastic introduction. It sounds like your timing couldn't be better to be getting into floating offshore wind. You know, it's interesting that the parent company decided to start the wind group. And I think in the pre-show conversation, we talked about some of the experience and some of the history of the parent company, why a floating wind may make interest. Maybe it makes sense to share with our audience is a little bit of that history, because I found that pretty fascinating. You know, you said you guys are good at all things floating, but why is that?
Yeah, great question. So the Aker Group can really trace its history back over 180 years. So been around a little while, and we are headquartered in Norway. And that kind of the common theme or the thread through that 180 years has been maritime or marine environment, so offshore or into the water, and innovation. Those kind of the two things that have been with us those 180 years. And I guess to be around 180 years, you have to have some innovation. You have to be able to transform yourself through time. The last, say, 5 decades or so, last 50 years or so, has been predominantly offshore energy, so offshore oil and gas predominantly, and designing a lot of the structures that are floating in deeper waters, whether it's off the coast of Norway, coast of the Gulf of Mexico, Africa, Asia. We've been very involved in a lot of those projects. If you look at just the semi-submersible market, which is the most common market for floaters, we have been involved in about 60% of those globally. So, you know, we know a thing or two about floating, and that has really transferred our you can transfer that knowledge into floating wind, which is kind of the next great market when we talk about floating structures in the water.
Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting. So, what are the key kind of you know, if you're looking at a kind of floating offshore wind turbine, what are the technical barriers that you've got to overcome there?
Yeah. Good question. And really, if you go really fundamentally, or the principal challenge is that we're dealing with large, these turbines are quite large. You know, we're talking 10 plus megawatt turbines, you know, upwards of, I'll use feet, 850 feet in the air, quite large. So stability in harsh weather, stability in high wind environments is a technical challenge. A lot of work has been done. I mentioned the Principal Power company. They've done a lot of good testing off the coast of Portugal, actually, in Europe, which is proven out a lot of those technical challenges. They had a great demo or pilot from 2011 to 2016, which proved out a lot of these in really harsh weather environments. You know, taking waves of 17 meters and keeping on operating, right? So a lot of lessons learned, but stability, being able to do it in a economical way. I think that's where we are as an industry. That's kind of the principal challenge, is driving down the cost of energy ultimately. And so scaling up and to be able to drive down the cost is really the principal economic challenge, if you will, for the industry. A lot of the technical challenges also come in the in terms of the mooring lines and the anchoring systems, the dynamic cables. Those are some of the principal challenges. These are solvable, not really big gnarly challenges, but there are things that we're trying to do in an economical way so we can, you know, put commercial scale floating wind farms out there. And it's probably worth me defining commercial scale, because that can, you know, depending who you talk to, right, that can be different. We typically define commercial scales above 100 megawatt. So it's a nice kind of round number to say, okay, above that, that's commercial scale. Everything to date, 30 megawatt high wind Scotland and 25 megawatt Windfloat Atlantic, and even now 50 megawatt Kincardine in England or Scotland. These are all kind of pre-commercial. We were learning a lot, but now we're stepping up into the commercial, you know, 100 plus megawatt scale projects.
So a project of that magnitude, what is deep water and how far offshore is that?
Yeah, it's you know, coming from the oil and gas world, when we say deep water, that has a certain definition in terms of water depth. In the offshore wind world, when we're talking deep water, that's anything beyond 60 meters. And so anything beyond that is typically floating, or we're evaluating floating. And we're even looking at, you know, maybe even 40 to 50 meter floating, and see if that's economical in some areas. Basically beyond that water depth, fixed bottom, which has been deployed. You know, there's, remember the, you know, 26, 28 gigawatts have been deployed, something like that, you know, globally. Virtually all of that has been fixed bottom. You're constrained though to the water depth, and you, a lot of the areas that have fixed bottom are kind of done, right? You don't have that, ability to, go to where the best wind is and get away from shore. So in the deep water, when we say 60 meters, what that also means, it's a bit further from shore. So traditionally or typically we're looking at 20, 25, 30 miles offshore. So kind of almost either beyond the horizon or just at the horizon, if you will. So the NIMBYism certainly is helps when you're way offshore.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. Preferable to onshore wind for anyone who has to live near a turbine, I would guess. Although I quite like looking at them. Given that they're, you know, so far offshore, as far as I understand it, one of the kind of key issues with offshore wind that can harm its economics is the operations and maintenance. It's just really difficult to get out to these things, and you don't want to go out with a big boat that you've had to hire for just a single one of these. Is that something you have to think about quite a lot, about trying to reduce the amount of operations and maintenance that any of your structures require? How do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. We think about that a lot, to be you know, quite fair. Because that is a big driver of your LCOE, or your levelized cost of energy, when you're looking at the 25, 30 year lifetime of these wind farms. So we, you know, a lot of people will focus on the CapEx, and that's right to do, to, you know, drive that down, make sure that is the right level. But if you do too much in the CapEx, you actually hurt your economics, because your OpEx, or your operating maintenance, it suffers, right? So there's a balance there. What we've been doing in the operation and maintenance, let's say portion of what we call the capital value process, is using digital technologies to really drive our ability to predict. And that's really important when we're talking about planning for operation maintenance. Planning for operation maintenance, you can put a budget for, and you can do. It's the unplanned maintenance that's the bugger, right? So the ability to in real time monitor, being able to condition monitor, but ultimately predict when there's going to be maintenance required, that's really that's the magic. One of the programs we're running right now, we're about a year into it. Actually, I'll bring it back to California for a second. We have a project, a grant with the California Energy Commission to look at this exact challenge. So to build a full digital twin of the entire wind farm and employ technology to be able to monitor in real time, when there's marine life or when there's avian events or water wave issues or anything, we can say, okay, what is the health and condition of that piece of equipment, of the structure, of everything? So we can say, okay, we need to send a boat out in 30 days or whatever. So we can plan for it and make that maintenance, make that repair.
So I understand the value of being able to predict. That seems like maybe a competitive advantage if that's what you're doing and you have the right sensors or monitors to do that. Are you building these from the ground up? Are you buying commercial parts? Are you buying these from manufacturers, or are these your turbines? You building these, speccing them, or how does that work?
Yeah, the turbine. So we focus on the full let's say life cycle, full set of equipment. We're not manufacturing turbines. So there are specialists. There are absolutely first rate OEMs, original equipment manufacturers that are building these turbines and are doing just tremendous work. And really, they're pushing the envelope in terms of materials, in terms of size, in terms of reliability. That is really impressive. So we're working with them. What we're doing from a digital twin standpoint is we're building a digital platform for them to incorporate their data into our platform. So we can, there are very clever software companies that are building apps on top of this to be able to allow us to very quickly and easily, very nice interface, monitor these big pieces of equipment, whether it's a turbine, whether it's a substructure, whether it's the cables, mooring lines, down the list.
Yeah. So to get one of these up, you need to find some kind of financing and get someone to, put the money in. Where's that coming from? I take it you don't do it off balance sheet, but it's some kind of debt financing.
Yeah, our projects, if you look kind of globally where we are, where Aker Offshore Wind is globally, we launched, like I said, just about a year ago, right? August of 2020, in the middle of the pandemic, which is an interesting time to launch a company, but shows the desire to do this. We started with what I call four flags on the map. If you look across globally, Korea, South Korea, Norway, UK, and the US. So those are our kind of four flags that we planted. We had early phase projects, and all of these are early phase development. So, when we're talking about FIDs and that kind of thing, it's in the second half of the 2020s. So that's kind of the timeline we're talking about here. Since we've launched, we've planted two more flags on the map. So early part of this year, we announced our interest in Sweden. And then just a few weeks ago, we kind of formalized the JV with Hexicon in Sweden. So that's the fifth flag, if you will. And then just in the middle of August, just recently, we announced our entry into Japan. So we are been the selected bidder to exclusive negotiations on an early phase project, 800 megawatt project with our partner Mainstream Renewables, and negotiating with Progression. So, we've now got six flag, or soon to be six flag, I guess, until we sign that. But that's been kind of where we see, and there's more flags to come. Not to lead you or anything, but there's more work going on there. But in terms of financing, it depends where we are in the world. Of course, we're very early. These are all very early phase developments. But we have a good partner in terms of our ownership, which is Aker Horizons. That's our parent company, and working with them for various financing needs and requirements.
So it's pretty exciting to be in so many places in getting the economies of scale that I imagine come with that. So as someone that doesn't know a whole lot, I'm going to ask some silly questions because that's why I'm here on the show. So being offshore in all those environments and places and seeing energy as critical infrastructure, how do you secure a wind farm that's offshore out of sight from potential problems, right? I don't know where the international waters lie. I don't know who's guarding their energy supply. But if you consider it critical infrastructure, which if wind and renewables becomes the amount of electricity that we're all moving towards, it becomes critical infrastructure. So it's no longer a rounding error when you get to the size scale projects you're talking about. How are you protecting them?
Yeah, great question. And each of the locations have different, governments have different ways to handle it. I'll use the U.S. because I sit in the U.S. and so I know it very well. But all of the waters basically beyond 3 miles from the coastline are in federal jurisdiction. So they're by BOEM, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. So all of the areas, and it goes out to roughly 200 nautical miles. So we're not there, we're not at 200. We're 20 to 30 miles, give or take. So in the U.S., they have a lease process. So they identify, they do a whole host of initial outreach and work on defining areas, and they issue a request for interest for a call area. So on the West Coast in California, there were originally three call areas that were put out for public comment and interest back in 2018. Just earlier this year, after the Biden administration's came in and issued their quite, I think, ambitious 30 gigawatt by 2030 goal, which is, we'll may talk about that later. They issued kind of the next, two of those three areas into the next phase of environmental analysis. So up in the North Coast, the Humboldt call area, and down in the Central Coast, the Morro Bay call area. And both of these areas, again, are 20 to 30 miles offshore. There'll be a host of environmental analysis ongoing. And then, about a year from now, fall of 2022, there'll be a lease auction for those areas. So that's how it's done in the U.S. And of course, once you get the lease, there's still a several year process to make sure you have all the permits in place before you actually put steel in the water and commence operations.
And then securing that, hold on before you ask your question, because that was the question was also, how do you protect the critical infrastructure when it's offshore in the open ocean?
Yeah, from a security standpoint, got you. I mean, look, there's a lot of, I think, really intelligent, smart people thinking through this in terms of how you make sure from an IT standpoint, so from a data standpoint, are securing things. From a physical infrastructure standpoint, there's a reason we're, had a long, let's say, fruitful discussion with the DOD in the West Coast, because a lot of their training is done on the West Coast, especially in the Central Coast near the Morro Bay call area. So there's a lot of dialogue there. But it is still it is critical infrastructure. We have eyes and ears on it at all times. I think that's the way we secure it.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on you talking about the Biden administration coming in. You rightly mentioned just there that this was probably going to come up. I thought, doing my prep for the show, I thought it was pretty interesting that you came into the role, just prior to his administration beginning. But I guess that the kind of planning for that was started in advance. And I wondered what the shift was in feeling or momentum as the Trump administration moved into the Biden one, and how much champagne you probably sort of cracked open at the results.
Yeah, I don't know about cracking open champagne. I think that building an industry is hard to do regardless of the administration, right? I think if you go back a decade or a little farther in the U.S., we kind of had almost a false start, right? I mean, with some tough stuff that was going on the East Coast, and I think there's a lot of reasons why it didn't take. I think from a technology standpoint, I think we weren't quite there yet. But I think we now are, certainly on the East Coast and the fixed bottom. Now it's, shifting to the West Coast and the floating. That's the next great wave of offshore wind. But look, I think it's really a good thing when an administration puts a goal out there that you can rally around. And I think that's really important. You can argue, is 30 gigawatts the right number? Okay, fair enough. But it's really important to rally around that, and it has absolutely energized the industry. I can speak from that. I can look at, you know, the various industry associations that are really rallying around this. And it also, I'd say, unleashes the supply chain. And I think that was one of the, it's one of kind of the, what I call the three big challenges that the industry still has is the development of the supply chain. And both on the East Coast, and we've seen some good movement there, but also on the West Coast. How do you deliver 30 gigawatts? That's not easy. So that's going to be, so I think the 30 gigawatt and the new administration was very good to unleash that ambition that had always been there.
There are so many parts that come together to produce, you know, an offshore wind farm, including, you know, vast supply chains, probably international ones. I was wondering, you know, with a target for 30 gigawatts by 2030, it has a nice ring to it, but what could stand in the way of that? You know, what are the roadblocks to that, in your opinion?
Well, I think, you know, first and foremost, the regulatory process has to be clear and transparent and expeditious. that's not always easy to do. What we've seen since the new administration has come in is a real energy in that inbound, right? And getting things progressed. There was quite a queue of various permits, whether it be COPs or SAPs or so forth, that just kind of were getting stuck a bit. We started to see really good movement in the last, you know, in the first, 8 months or so of the new administration. You've seen, you know, the first commercial scale, you know, 800 plus megawatt project Vineyard Wind reached financial closure just recently. And you're seeing, you know, gigawatts of projects now progressing, and that's a really good sign. Now the challenge, or maybe the discussion, is moved to how do we streamline this? You know, that I mentioned the, you know, it can be 4 or 5 years of permitting to go from, you know, getting the lease, right, securing the lease, to actually making a financial decision, FID. How can you streamline that? I think what I've been really encouraged, and I think the industry has been really encouraged, is BOEM thinking through how do we do that, right? How do we streamline this? Using the, you know, look at all the digital tools we have today. Can we do things in a more expeditious, you know, still doing the diligence, still doing the deep environmental analysis and so forth, but using digital technologies to actually accelerate that. I think that's really exciting. And that would be a huge step forward for the industry.
So accelerating makes sense. It's probably also for your investors, probably appreciate that as well, to not have a project take 5 years to get a go, no go. You mentioned there were three hurdles a question or two ago. So you also just mentioned environmental impact. So what would be gating, besides regulation or getting approvals, What are some of the risks or the gates to getting a large scale project going? Because it's not a prototype, it's not a small project, or it's a big commitment once someone says yes. So what are the possible hurdles?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. So the three, what I call the three big challenges for offshore wind, and you know, this is floating wind and fixed bottom wind. So we'll look at the total market, but the three big challenges that I see are port infrastructure, or maybe the lack of port infrastructure currently, and we are starting to see some good movement there. But that's one. Two is transmission, and the ability. And we're talking about large multi gigawatt power plants that are offshore. How do we transmit that onto shore and get it to the load centers in an efficient way? And the supply chain. And the development of that supply chain, both domestically and internationally, those three challenges are really, to me, critical. So if you see movement in those three, you can see, you know, we're making progress. We're starting to see, you know, on the West Coast, we're starting to see port infrastructure be, or funding for the port infrastructure, start to be released. So that's really a positive. That's a first indication that, there will be something here.
So what needs to be done when you say port infrastructure? That's pretty broad. I mean, I always think of Long Beach when you think of the West Coast and port, because that's the port. What is the gap and where is the infrastructure need to be improved and what specifically?
Yeah, no, great question. And you're right. It is probably too broad when I say it, to be fair. But port infrastructure, ideally you want your port of assembly. So we're assembling these large structures, the substructure, the floating piece, as well as the turbine, blades, nacelle, and tower, all in the port. So ideally you want a port that's relatively close to your wind farm. You don't want to have to tow it, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles. You don't want to do that. So ideally you put a port relatively close to where that wind farm is. I'll use the example of the North Coast in California, the port of Humboldt Bay, which is a fantastic port. And it's very close to the call area. It's about, you know, 25, 30 miles from the call area. So ideal location. This is a port that was mainly a timber export port, but with the timber industry, you know, kind of going downhill several decades ago, you know, it just hasn't been had enough investment in it to really maintain it and be able to take the weight bearing of these large components. You know, when we're talking about large structures and assembling and constructing, you know, these are big pieces. These are multi-ton, hundreds of tons type of stuff. You need to be able to move that around on shore and the crane capacity to be able to do this. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done at not just Port Humboldt, which they have got some initial funding from the state of California, which is great, but all up and down the West Coast, as well as up and down the East Coast. You have seen some good movement in the East Coast as well, up in the Northeast, as well as even down in the Mid-Atlantic states on that.
Okay, so that was one. So hold on a second. I want to finish the point. So the ports, I heard that you talked about supply chain, and I forget your third point at the moment.
What I always say, the second is transmission.
Transmission. That was the one I wanted to go to next, because that to me is, how are you solving that? And then is there a grid around to receive all this additional power? Because it's kind of fragile, as I understand, at least in North America. Now, you're all globally. There may be other, maybe better in other countries. But sorry, I'd love to go through the three. And I know my colleague's dying to ask a question, but I want to hear the response.
No, that's okay. Transmission's a big subject. And to be fair, probably, you know, you probably do a full podcast just on transmission and the challenges around it. But largely, you know, if we look at California, you know, they're projected with their legislation now in place, with their SB 100 legislation, which, you know, basically dictates they have to be at 100% clean energy by 2045. So in the next, what, I'd say 25 years, but it's actually 23 and a half years or so. They need to bring on about 140 gigawatts of renewable energy. Their current transmission capacity can't handle that. It just can't. So there's the big problem or big challenge is understood. Now it's, where do you deploy that transmission capacity and capability to make sure that we're taking advantage of where these big renewable energy projects are? So the very current legislation, which just passed just a couple of weeks ago, it's called AB 525. What that does is it requires the California Energy Commission to put a roadmap out for transmission as well as ports to be able to serve about 10 gigawatts of offshore wind. That would cover the first two call areas in which I mentioned, Humboldt and Morrow, and then probably some additional ones as well. But it starts to lay out that roadmap. And if anybody's been around transmission, it does take a while to not only just to plan it, but to actually permit it and construct it. So that is it's a big challenge for not just California. I'm using them as an example. That's kind of across the globe. Now there are areas, let's say first mover areas where there may be, you know, a fossil fuel plant or a thermal plant that may be coming offline, being retired in you know, a couple years or a few years where there's a, you know, a big plug that you can plug into. So there are some opportunities there. That happens to be one of the interesting parts about Morro Bay, the Central Coast, is that the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant is coming offline in 2025. That's a 2+ gigawatt project or a plant. You know, that's a logical place for 2 gigawatts of offshore wind to plug into. So there are opportunities there.
So does this mean that we're likely to see sort of big clusters of offshore, capacity in the future, and we get, a finite small number of real hubs of offshore capacity where you've got excellent ports, great transmission network, big demand hubs nearby? Or is that not how you see it?
I think that is the initial wave of projects. That's exactly right. And you know what that initial wave is. I mean, depends what analysts you listen to, right? And we've got our own internal projections on that. But certainly, tens of gigawatts in the U.S. That we see. We talk about 30 gigawatts by 2030, right? And there's a small amount of floating there, but really the bulk of the deployment of floating is the latter half of the 2020s into the 2030s. What we don't also talk about is the 110 gigawatt target for 2050 in the US, right? That's, you can start to see the growth. We have started to talk about the floating wind target, and that's probably 30 gigawatts by 2040. So in the next 20 years, you're gonna see that type of deployment. But that, it doesn't stop there. I mean, the reality is the best wind resources are in the floating, where, in the deeper waters where floating is going to be the technology of choice. In the U.S., it's something like 60% of the resources are in waters deeper than 60 meters. Globally, it inches up. It's closer to 80% of total resources. So there's a lot of potential. And as the cost curve comes down, which we've seen, right, and we have our own targets to be basically at cost parity with fixed bottom by the end of this decade, you can see floating wind really being deployed at a massive scale.
You've perfectly anticipated my question. I was going to ask you about that that kind of divide between fixed bottom and floating offshore, and how you saw that trending. So it's starting cheaper at the moment is the fixed bottom, is what I'm hearing. But by 2040, do you say that you expect to see cost 2030? You expect to see cost parity, and then the resources out there, the economics are there. There's no reason why you would go fixed bottom after that point.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a couple different factors here, of course, at play. Is that one is the areas that are being leased now or have been leased recently are all predominantly fixed bottom. So those prime spots are effectively, there are fewer and fewer of those prime spots. So the prime wind is further offshore and in deeper waters. That's a piece of it. The other piece in terms of the cost, let's say the cost story or the cost trajectory, is that we've seen tremendous decrease in the fixed bottom cost across the globe, right? In Europe, you're seeing, great cost reductions, whether it's in the UK or other parts of Europe. What not a lot of people talk about is that in floating, 60 to 70% of the components that we use are the same components in fixed bottom. So we're basically, I don't say taking advantage, but effectively using those cost savings in what we're doing. So our focus is on that remaining 30 to 40%. It's the unique characteristics of floating. So that's, and when we look at that 30, 40% remaining, we see that coming down quite dramatically over the next, 7 to 8 years.
So I guess the one thing in your logic that jumped out at me was, I think you said these things have a 20 to 30 year life expectancy, and you said all the prime fixed bottom is already built, and so does that mean that they decommission that in the future and it all goes to floating? Because it would seem that there'd be a renewal time about the time your price point of floating dropped, right? From from the, what you just described. And I'm not trying to catch you up. I kind of heard that and I'm like, well, that would seem about the time that the infrastructure in place right now would be aging out, right? It would be time to upgrade.
Yeah, possibly. And just to be clear, not all of the fixed bottom areas is gone. It's just a lot of the prime real estate is gone. And it, you know, they're still out there, but just not as much. But in terms of the cost parity, when we get to, you know, let's say 2030, that's the number we've put on. You know, we're at cost parity. Does it dip below? You know, I don't know. I mean, it's you know, how long is a piece of string? I don't know. So you know, we'll see. You know, whether it becomes whether you decommission a fixed bottom and put a floating in. You know, maybe one of the challenges and one of the areas the industry is looking at right now is this, what we call the transition zone, right? This 40 to 60 meter, where it's in some cases floating works at cost, at the right cost. Sometimes 40 to 60 meters is because of seafloor conditions, fixed bottom just doesn't work. Either the soil conditions just don't lend itself to being structurally sound. So there will be those areas. You know, do you decommission a fixed bottom and put a floating in? Maybe, but that's, you know, that's, we'll see. I mean, that's a future question. I don't know.
I wasn't trying to trip you up. I was just kind of looking at the economics. So in kind of a scale, when you start doing things at scale, there's two things that kind of strike me. Once again, layperson question is, you know, if wind patterns and global warming are changing things and you're doing things at scale, do you get to a point where your large wind installation also starts changing wind behavior by having such a large installation? What does that do to the prevailing wind in the region?
Yeah, I think, you know, I can't answer the question, you know, I'm not a climatologist, so I don't know, you know, does the jet stream change or anything like that? I mean, those are always risks, I guess. What we look is at more of a localized level, you know, the wake effect of a wind farm, you know, especially a large wind farm, and making sure we're spacing and siting these turbines and these farms in the right locations. And it's not just the wind, you know, we got to look at other ocean users, you know, whether that's, you know, vessels, whether that's fishermen, whether that's migratory patterns, you know, there's a whole host of other ocean users we have to be conscious of. But in terms of, you know, do the wind patterns change with a large deployment, you know, globally of offshore wind turbines or wind turbines in general? Not my area of expertise by any stretch, but it seems a little to me a little far fetched that we change the wind pattern of the world by putting some wind turbines out there.
Yeah, just curious. So I think we're getting close to time. I'm going to give it to Will to see what final thoughts or questions he might have.
I think it's been a fantastic conversation. I don't have any questions presenting themselves at the moment. I think it's been a great conversation. All the questions I had coming in have been answered with fantastic detail. Yeah.
Well, I still have a question or two. So I get the spacing. Absolutely. I had no skin in the game on the wind. I was just curious. So I don't have an opinion there, but I hear you say these things are spaced out. So when you're put one of these in, how many square miles is one of these wind farms, or how big are one of these things when they're at full deployment at scale?
Yeah, I mean, they can be pretty big. When you're looking at, you know, the call areas that we're looking at in the West Coast, you know, quite large, right? I mean, these are big call areas. Now, in terms of, you know, how much space we'll actually use for a gigawatt or for 500 megawatts, you know, that's something we try to, you know, be conscious of, in terms of when we're doing environmental assessments and so forth. So we need to be really, careful, and it's very site specific, to make sure we're spacing out appropriately for whether it's vessel traffic or what other things there are out in the call area. But in terms of spacing, I mean, I typically have a picture in my background of, you know, I know we're all always on virtual meetings and so forth. And it gives a sense of how, you know, these are, you know, 1.5 kilometer, you know, a mile in between each turbine. I mean, that's kind of the size that we're talking about. Each turbine, you know, basically anybody who's doing floating right now is looking at, you know, 15 plus megawatt turbines. I mean, pretty much. There may be some occasions where it's a little smaller than that. And we're all looking at, you know, above 100 megawatts. So you can kind of get a sense of how large these fields and these farms are.
Absolutely. So my last question then is your crystal ball. So you're into this, your project. Where are you guys in 5 years?
That's a great question. Well, I think where the industry is, maybe I'll do it that first and then go to the projects that we're in. I mean, I think the industry is starting to deploy floating at a fairly rapid pace. You know, we're seeing, you know, smaller projects being deployed right now. You know, I mentioned the Kincardine project, which just came online just in a matter of a few weeks this summer. It came online, a 50 megawatt floating array off the coast of Scotland. We'll see, an 88 megawatt called Hywind Tampen in Norway, which will come online next year. So by, 26, 27 time period, you know, we're starting to see 200 plus megawatt projects being deployed. Maybe even higher than that. I think you'll see most likely Korea being the first large scale projects being deployed, you know, 250 plus megawatt type projects being deployed. And then soon thereafter, California will be right behind them. So I think that it's a really exciting time. You know, in 5 years, if the crystal ball holds true, you'll see a lot of floating turbines spinning off the coast of Korea and maybe even off the coast of California.
Very cool. Well, I want to thank you for joining us today. I've enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for indulging my questions, because I'm sure they're a bit all over the place for you. But I feel like I learned a lot. Thank you for being our guest.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. I'll just leave you with, the future is floating. And we'll leave it at that. Thanks for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. And 5 years from now, I'm looking forward to the future you described. For our audience, you've spent another hour listening to Insider's Guide to Energy. If you've yet to subscribe, don't forget to hit the subscribe button. We do have YouTube videos up as well, where you can watch the sausage being made, as I say, see behind the scenes, or you can continue just to download the podcast, as many of you are doing, and continue to enjoy Will on stories, because those stories are knocking it out of the park. Thank you very much. We'll see you next week.